Global Governance Futures is brought to you from the Global Governance Institute at University College London. This is a podcast about the challenges facing humanity and possible global responses. How does the world hang together? What has gone wrong? And what has global governance got to do with it? To learn more, please visit ucl.ac.uk/global-governance.
Professor Abdullah An-Naim begins our conversation with a personal reflection on growing up in Sudan while still under British colonial rule, and the profound impact of reading the classic post-colonial novel Season of Migration to the North by the celebrated Sudanese novelist Taib Salih while still in high school. This sets the stage for a profound exploration of the core themes within Abdullah's book Decolonizing Human Rights, informed by over 40 years of experience working as an academic and advocate for human rights reform through internal cultural transformation. As a world-renowned Muslim advocate for human rights, Abdullah has strongly challenged the notion that Islamic views are inherently incompatible with human rights, and it is upon this firm conviction that he advances a powerful critique of the Western-centric liberal human rights orthodoxy. Above all, Abdullah argues that universality in human rights should be seen as a project which is always under construction, a project which must be built from the ground up, based upon genuine dialogue and understanding across cultures.
Universality is not a given. It is something that we have to cultivate, something that we have to grow and build over time, and that all of us have a voice in this. But each will have to be according to our own context, according to our own culture and roots.
This is Imperfect Utopias or Bust, Global Governance Futures. Professor Abdullah An-Naim is the Charles Howard Candler Professor of Law, Emeritus at Emory Law. His research interests include constitutionalism in Islamic and African countries, secularism and human rights. We spoke with him in July 2023.
I was just reading some of the background documents that Tom prepared for this, and then reading about your background, and it just reminded me of this time last year when I read for the first time A Season of Migration to the North by Taib Saleh. Okay. Yes, and I thought, who better than to ask firstly about the work itself and whether or not you read it and its influence on you, but also what has your experience been moving from a traditional or Islamic culture into the Western academy? And if you could tell us a bit about your story and not only how that affects your work, but also potentially how that affects your sense of identity, I think that would be really interesting to begin with.
Yes. Okay, good. Yeah. In fact, Season of Migration to the North is a defining piece of scholarly literature, I should say, for my generation of Sudanese. Because when it first appeared, I was in my high school, I think, and I read it in Arabic originally and then subsequently in English. And through the decades, I have often went back to that work and in my own mind, without necessarily reading the text, because the text is really imprinted in my soul. And it is absolutely brilliant how I identify with the persons in the novel, and also the whole exactly as you put it, my experience as a Sudanese of the post-colonial era. I was born 1946, and Sudan became independent in 1956. So the first 10 years of my life, Sudan was still a British colony, or Anglo-Egyptian, they call it, but Egypt itself was protected, quote unquote, by Britain. So, and the sense of, interestingly, how in my own, of course, only in retrospect do I see this now, how I totally identified with the post-colonial. I saw, I'm really a successful product of the post-colonial, in the sense that I'm a post-colonial subject. My consciousness, my intellectual and professional and educational qualifications were British. I went to Cambridge and Edinburgh, went back to teach in Sudan. At the time, I saw that this is the way it should be, or this is the way it is. I mean, that So when human rights to me was something that was intuitive, immediate, I didn't ever at any point need to think of justifying it to myself. And it is never an issue. So it is not an issue then, it is not an issue now. For me, it is absolutely essential and basic and inherent to humanity that human beings, as human beings, have these rights. But then going through the years, and maybe our conversation can come to this again, how my years at Human Rights Watch and before and after, because I lived out, you know, in various situations of exile since 1985, UCLA and then Washington, D.C., and then Canada, and then Sweden and Cairo, and back to Washington for Human Rights Watch. But all along, I do write about this, I think, more recently in the 90s, how initially I took human rights for granted. This is the way it is. This is what they mean. This is the way they can be implemented or enforced. What was problematic for me as a Muslim is Sharia, certain aspects of it, which were totally indefensible from a human rights perspective or a moral perspective, as well as a political perspective. It is a tremendous hypocrisy what Muslim Islamists engage in about human rights, about Sharia being consistent with. It is not. It cannot be, because it is defining the human in religious terms and classifying people in terms of the religious affiliation. So, but then the time in the 90s came when I started questioning the human rights side of the equation. It is not that the human rights don't exist. Of course, they do exist. But the existence is not by existence of violations, but by the existence of effective mechanisms of enforcement and protection. So human rights were never in issue as a concept, as an idea, but the way they are defined internationally and expected to be protected through international relations was beginning to falter in my view. And I could see the hypocrisy, the double standards, and eventually I could come into my years at Human Rights Watch to illustrate that more concretely.
Would you be happy to explain then why the stars fell from your eyes on human rights? What hypocrisy did you see? Some examples, remember, perhaps.
Yes, of course. I will give you a very glaring example. There is something I call human rights dependency, which is the idea of Amnesty and Human Rights Watch and other international so-called human rights advocacy groups to document human rights violations that they choose to document in locations they choose to decide on, and to publish about them to their own constituencies. So the people who are whose human rights violations are being investigated are not really part of the story. They are just simply subjects of study, almost like a lab where you have your microscope and you look at these situations. You parachute into a place that you decide deserves attention, child labor or FGM or whatever the issue that you decide is urgent. And then you send a team of two or three researchers to draw on the research or the work that existing or local indigenous human rights groups have done. You take it and come to New York or London to write your report. You publish it in English at a time when you say there is a hook to an international event, you know, that your primary target are so-called donor governments. You want to influence their foreign policy regarding the offending governments in Africa or elsewhere. And then you release a report and you expect things to happen. You don't know. And I seen that. I was the director of Human Rights Watch Africa when Rwanda genocide happened. And I went to Rwanda immediately after the genocide ended 2 or 3 months after the end of the genocide. And I could see how the damage, psychological and emotional and physical, to the whole environment and community. And what happened in Rwanda? How that the UN was in Kigali when the genocide started. And 20 days later, they were pulled out of Kigali by the Security Council. So when the international, so-called international community, was supposed to act to prevent and protect against the genocide, they pulled out the force that was on the ground that could have intervened and with minimal effort, I think, could have stopped the genocide from happening. So that was the level of hypocrisy and double standards I see. How the Clinton administration, they refused to define what was happening in Rwanda at the time as genocide. They called it genocidal acts, because calling it genocide invokes their obligation internationally to prevent and punish. So, but let me, I'm sorry to carry on like this, but let me give you a very specific example. In 1991 also, there was the Ethiopian overthrow of Mengistu, I mean the military junta in Ethiopia, and the reinstallment or reinstation of democratic self-governance and so on by the Ethiopian people. But then there was the question of what to do with the military and other sort of responsibles for the crimes that were committed during the previous regime. There were more than 100,000 of them, huge number. And they didn't know what to do because it was going to take a long time. So they went through the motions of going through, investigations, and some Nordic countries gave them computers to install all the information. And it was going on. So I was, as director of Africa Watch, I chose to go and stay for a month in Addis Ababa at the time. And I thought the best thing was to try to create local political support for the accountability initiative. So I started talking to local journalists to write in local newspapers, in local languages, about why the junta and those who were responsible for the crimes should be punished and how they can be punished effectively. And so that we never again, that notion of never again. So when I went back to New York, I was very excited. I mean, Human Rights Watch Africa was based in Washington, but the main offices of Human Rights Watch was in New York. So I went to the meetings there and I was proudly presenting newspaper cuttings and articles in local languages about how local journalists were writing about the issues. And I remember that the director of Human Rights Watch pushed away my papers. Nonsense, he said, waste of time. So the effort to create local constituency and local political support for accountability to him was nonsense, waste of time. But writing the reports in order to be released to coincide with the World Bank meeting or G7 meeting, that was the whole object of the advocacy and what it means. So that's how, in fact, that was the issue I resigned over, because I resigned from being director of Africa Watch in April 1995, eventually because I couldn't get any support within Human Rights Watch for the idea that we have to leave something behind, that we cannot just simply go and investigate these situations, come and report about them to invoke some sort of response, which may or may not happen. And that was the end of the story. Then we move on to the next issue. I thought that we have to create local constituencies, local capacity to protect. It is inherent to being human that you protect your own rights. So that is the double standards and hypocrisy that I was talking about.
So Abdu, if I might come in here, I mean, one of the concerns that's often voiced by non-Western and also, frankly, non-American human rights scholars and advocates is that often within those sort of the official human rights domains in Washington or New York, human rights is really understood more as a foreign policy concern than something that is rooted within a domestic political context. And I'm curious to ask, I mean, given your early experience in Sudan during the 70s and the 80s, and of course, your own persecution as part of the Islamic reform movement under Usta Mahmud Taha, who was executed for apostasy in 1985. And of course, you were then forced into exile shortly afterwards. I mean, how do you feel that very difficult experience at a very formative time in your life, how did that perhaps assist you in terms of coming to your own conclusions as to what human rights actually are? So when you encountered the Western discourse within these very powerful environments such as Human Rights Watch, I mean, were you aware of sort of the discordance very early on between your own sort of intuitive understanding, academic understanding, and what you encountered among your colleagues in those spaces?
No, actually, I was completely sold to the idea of so-called, I didn't even see it as Western or liberal human rights discourse. I saw it as the human rights discourse. Throughout the 70s and 80s, of course, when I did my PhD in Edinburgh, I was drawing on international human rights standards as well regarding criminal procedure issues. In Cambridge, I studied public law, which also took constitutional human rights in constitutional terms as the foundation of protection of human rights. So all of this was to me something, yeah, this is the way it is. And that's why I call myself a post-colonial subject, that I am a product of that education, of that advocacy and so on. And it was only later, almost 10 years after I started my life in exile, that I began to question those assumptions. The thing is that I was suspicious, and I still do reject the so-called relativist discourse of Islamists who claim that, oh, no, we don't need to human rights at all. Islam protects human rights before anybody else. Of course not. This is not true. Historically false. And it is apologetic discourse that is intended to hide more than to protect violations of human rights. But to me, I think the Human Rights Watch experience was a rude awakening, was a sobering experience, in that what I assumed that my colleagues in New York will celebrate the fact that I could generate some local discourse about accountability for human rights violations by the military junta in Ethiopia. But they were, in fact, none of them spoke out when the director pushed away my newspaper cuttings as nonsense, waste of time. So that was sobering. And then I started questioning the issues that I see. Now, I do not, that's why I always try to highlight that my mission is two-fronted or twofold. Again, it's Sharia and for universality of human rights, but in truly universal terms. So I think what I see as problematic, as I started earlier saying, is that it is never a question of human rights violation. Injustice exists. Atrocities exist. I was in Kober prison in northern Khartoum North, when people were tortured in the same prison and we could hear them, and when the so-called Islamic punishments started being implemented in 1983-84, they were implemented just next door to us. There was just a single wall And we could hear the shouts of the Islamists, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, and so on. So it is immediate, it is personal, and it is total in the sense that for me, I have to be able to confront views of Sharia as human and not divine, because they are the product of human interpretation of so-called divine, what people believe to be divine message. I am Muslim, I believe that to be divine message, but it can never be implemented and comprehended and implemented except through human consciousness and through human political will. So that is on the Islamic side. But also on the international side, I began to see the hypocrisy and double standards also going on constantly. I mean, the way that the advocacy, the constituency for advocacy was northern constituency. The priorities were northern priorities. That's what I later on came to call liberal relativism. That by all means, I mean, liberals have a right, and I am a liberal in the sense of my subscribing to views of human rights in liberal terms, yes, philosophically and culturally and emotionally. But that is not the whole story. And if we focus exclusively on the liberal perspective, including the question of justiciability, which for me is a major issue, that the expectation that human rights have to be enforced by the state itself is paradoxical. By definition, they are supposed to be the rights independent of what the state is willing to do or fail to do. Yet this whole structure is premised on the idea that it is states which negotiate the treaties. It is states which decide to adopt or not to adopt, and subject to ratification, and then to implement in their own terms according to their own understanding. And of course, in the common law jurisdictions, United States, Britain, Canada, and so on, that you find that implementation has to happen by domestic legislation to incorporate international standards into domestic law. Now, when that happens, they are no longer human rights. They are civil rights, because they are protected by the state, defined by the state, enforced by the state, which is just like any other constitutional set of rights, which is fine. It is good to have that, but we should not claim it to be universal human rights. So it is to me, maybe I am an odd person or entity in this discourse, that I never oppose the liberal discourse on its own terms. I just oppose its claim to speak in the voice of humanity at large.
I think this is a very important point you're making, Abdu, because it seems to me that, you know, your very very impressive magisterial book, Decolonizing Human Rights, it really is a reflection on the complexity and the an authentic desire to engage with the liberal notion of human rights, but from a position which doesn't necessarily self-identify as liberal, or indeed, I'm not sure whether you would associate yourself with any particular camp within the human rights scholarship. Mm. But what really strikes me is that it's a reflection of 3, 4, 5 decades of experience and academic engagement. And what's revealed through that process of sifting and you know, deep thinking and dialogue with many colleagues and friends and adversaries as well, is a whole host of paradoxes. This is what sort of comes through. So, you know, we've spoken about Rwanda, which I think is a very egregious example of double standards within a foreign policy context. The Ethiopia example perhaps speaks to something a little bit more subtle. And, you know, for as one example of one of this paradox, you speak of the right to difference, yes, as a human right. And I think initially that's quite a difficult idea to get across to someone who's immersed in an orthodox understanding of human rights. But I think in the context of this conversation, what comes through is that often in the West, or those who speak for human rights in the West, it often comes across as, you know, we're asking to have a dialogue about human rights, but how it's received is essentially, let's talk about this until you agree with us, since we already know the answer.
Yes, exactly. I think that was my problem. If I may, Tom, just to note that I came to this over time. It was not like I grew up with it or suddenly realized the whole dimension of the complexity and double standards, but that it is an evolving discourse in my own personal consciousness and identity. Tom earlier referred to identity. My identity as a Muslim advocate of human rights. And I remember that I used to always insist on, I speak of human rights from an Islamic perspective, which of course counterintuitive to the audience who think that, well, Islam is inherently inconsistent or incompatible with human rights. I remember a Dutch scholar, I wouldn't mention by name, but of course he was a good friend, but he kept asking me, why do you insist on speaking as a Muslim or from a Muslim perspective? And I used to say, because that's how I feel. That is what human rights, that's how they make sense to me. And that's how my own conviction and drive comes from that inner feeling that I am at peace with myself as a Muslim, precisely because I am able to support human rights in this way. So it is that, I don't seem, I am glad that you put it that way. I don't identify with any camp because I believe that, you know, in 1992, I edited a book called Human Rights in Cross-Cultural Perspectives, : Quest for Consensus. And the idea in that book is to say that universality is not a given. It is something that we have to cultivate, something that we have to grow and build over time. And that all of us have a voice in this, but each will have to be according to our own context, according to our own culture and roots. And therefore, I spoke of two things, what I call internal cultural discourse and cross-cultural dialogue. That by internal cultural discourse, I meant the transformation of cultural consciousness and awareness of rights of women, of religious minorities. When I speak about the right to difference, I speak about what I mean is that it is basic to humanity that you are the person you choose to be. This, what I call a radical notion of self-determination, is inherent also in the discourse. So in that sense, I was confronting and being part of a movement that was repressed in Sudan, and I had to leave. Being part of that, I think I know what I mean when I say that when I speak about internal cultural discourse. Then cross-cultural dialogue is to what I call build on Rawls' notion of overlapping consensus, that despite our disagreement as to where we support or why we come to support human rights, we can have a common ground on which we can build a universal notion. So universality is not a given, and it is not, it is a project. It is a work in progress. And all what we all do is part of that. Either we hamper the evolution of the notion of universality by insisting on our own relativity, or we are willing to challenge our relativities in order to come to a common understanding of what it means to be human. And that is what I take again is the so-called North American, in particular American notions, Northeastern United States notion of universality, which is so really parochial and imperial. So we lead and the rest of the world follows. We decide, so we choose to ratify two or three treaties, but we report annually on the human rights performance of every single state, including Western allies like the United States, Britain and Western Europe and so on. Meaning that if you know, the US has two world reports on human rights. Both of them are published in Washington by the State Department to you know, like a report card, what this country did, what that state did, and so on. But, you know, they report on every single state except the United States. Because it is not an issue. Of course, we are human rights friendly, but we don't ratify treaties. And the treaties we ratify, we empty of all meaningful content by the reservations we make, but we are still the leaders and the model of what human rights protection is supposed to be. But we choose to apply it hypocritically, double standard ways of you know, even that so-called annual world report on human rights and the other one on freedom of religion, the international freedom, so-called. It's a product of the United States Congress, and they call it the International Religious Freedom Act. What's international about it? When its own definition of religion is American, when its own definition of what to do about violations of religious freedom is to give the president of the United States the discretion of whether or not to impose sanctions on the country which has offended. So as a result, Saudi Arabia and Israel are never punished for any human, although the report their human rights violations, but there is never a question of punishing Saudi Arabia for its human rights violations or freedom of religion violations. So the foreign policy dimension is that we're sort of relying on foreign policy to promote the protection of human rights is really an invitation to the old, you know, business as usual type of attitudes. We say the Cold War was over, but it's not over. It has not been over. Now, Russia is in the Ukraine, and the United States invaded and occupied Iraq for 10 years. What was that if it was not Cold War politics and foreign relations?
Indeed. So one of your strongest critiques is very much this idea of liberal relativism. I mean, the other aspect, I think, which perhaps is most confronting for readers of your book is, or actually in some ways most challenging, is to really grapple with what you do you actually mean by the universality of human rights. And indeed, you have, you know, you have these rhetorical questions in the book. You ask yourself, you know, what is universal about locally defined human rights? Does universality require uniformity? And you present as a categorical principle this idea of self-determined universality. Now, perhaps you could explain what you mean by that term, and then also just to perhaps preempt the provocation, I could imagine some human rights scholars responding, well, you know, it's all very well and good to say that human rights will be more deeply entrenched in a society that if they reflect the local culture and local morality. But, you know, we can't abandon the international human rights standards in the UN Universal Declaration or wherever they may be, and simply have faith that eventually a bottom-up consensus will be reached by all of these societies in the world. So how do you pass out and respond to that sort of concern? Is it a misunderstanding of your premise, your argument?
Yes, it is, I think, and let me explain. For one thing, I'm not talking about abandoning the Universal Declaration in order to come to this universality that is evolving from grassroots discourse. I'm saying that fill that universal claim of international protection of human rights by cultural legitimacy and really building constitutional, what I call human cultural transformation and political mobilization, so that everywhere that is the case. Now, let me challenge the so-called Western liberal perspective to say that we cannot abandon the international. Take the death penalty and gay and lesbian rights, you know, sexual orientation. Neither of them was explicitly defined or mentioned in the Universal Declaration or in other treaties, the treaties that followed. But by now, under the European Human Rights Convention, and also under, in fact, even when the European Convention was drafted in 1950, exclusively by Western European states, it did not include prohibition of the death penalty, and it has nothing to say about sexual orientation. But by now, these are taken as obviously almost for granted as human rights violations or human rights concerns in Western Europe under the European Convention. But it took European societies to come to those convictions by themselves on their own terms before they were willing to protect them in their own region by protocols and European Union type of process. So in other words, that when it comes to you, you will never dream of imposing human rights standards as you see them. So if I stand up and talk about the right to development or right freedom of protection of peace and so on, you tell me, no, this cannot be a human right because it is not justiciable, because it's a collective right. So who says that collective rights cannot be human rights? And who says that justiciability is required for the quality of being a human rights violation? It is a Western liberal or West European liberal and North American liberal perspective on that. So you can present your perspective, but you have to take mine and let us talk about them and see why not. Why should, by the way, the notion of legal protection by coercive enforcement is really hypocritical and totally empty, because you cannot protect the rights of women by enforcement in their own communities. So are you going to have your troops occupy country in order to force parents to send their daughters to school? And are you going to accompany those daughters to school so you'll protect them from attacks by the Taliban or whoever? Nothing, of course, of that can happen. And the idea of coercive enforcement itself is a violation of the right to self-determination. States are not willing to take that charge. Now we see the tragedy in the Ukraine, and we condemn Russia for its aggression, but we did nothing about Yemen. We did nothing about all types of situation. Iraq, the United States, exactly what Russia is doing in the Ukraine is what the United States did in Iraq. Absolutely unilateral determination that its own sort of expansive, preemptive self-defense. That's what Russia is claiming in the Ukraine. That's what the United States is claimed in Iraq, so-called preemptive. And they call it the Bush Doctrine. Nonsense. It is neither a Bush nor a doctrine. It is purely American imperialism asserting itself in the name of international law and international legality. Now Russia is doing it, the whole Western world is up in arms and supplying arms, but they are not willing to engage themselves in protecting democracy and human rights in the Ukraine because they are afraid of what Russia might do. Now this is the level of hypocrisy and really unforgivable sort of double standards, that you are pushing the Ukraine to fight, but you are not willing to fight yourself. And you claim that you are doing it in the protection of human rights and so on, but you did nothing about the United States in Iraq let alone the United States in Afghanistan, which was also another tragedy and tremendous defeat of the idea of, you know. By the way, there is something I speak of, I think, which is what I call international legality. It's a liberal notion, but it's also, in human history, it has its roots, which is the idea that you protect rights through law, not through unilateral action. It is not vigilante justice. But none of us is willing to comply with the rule of law in international relations. We impose the rule of law in international relations when it chooses, when it pleases us, and we withhold it when it doesn't. But the idea that, every time that you have this notion of the Britain sending, Margaret Thatcher sending the British fleet to the South Pacific or South Atlantic to fight for the Balkans, so-called, because they are British. How can that be? I mean, and again, she did not seek or achieve any degree of international sanction for that. So that is, you know, I mentioned this example, although people may not know about it much. I wonder if Tom knows about it. It's your generation, maybe somewhat. I was in Britain at the time, and it was really almost a throwback into imperial British, you know, Britannia and the rule of the waves and all that. So how dare the Argentina challenge our sovereignty over the Falklands? But who is going to challenge your sovereignty over the Falklands in the first place? How did you acquire that? Those are the issues that I struggle with. I'm grateful for this opportunity. And let me say that I'm inviting challenge to everything I said. And in fact, I call it, you know, if I'm not challenged, I'm not relevant. Because if I'm telling what people already accept, if I'm presenting already what people accept, what's the point of saying it? I gave a lecture in Oxford. I used to teach sometimes in that human rights course at Oxford New College. And I gave a lecture in 1917. It's on YouTube. And I called it Decolonizing Human Rights, Plea for Challenge or for Rebuttal. Yeah, that's what I used. I said that specifically. It was a whole crowd of international human rights scholars, students who are doing their masters, and others who were in the room. And I said, listen, I'm presenting this view that we need to decolonize human rights, why we need to decolonize, and how we can do it. And I'm inviting and pleading for rebuttal. And when I concluded, it's all on YouTube, as I said, I said, okay, now, I'm inviting this crowd to challenge what I'm saying. What is wrong with it? What is wrong with what I'm saying? So I have no hesitation whatsoever to defend. In fact, I believe that I'm relevant precisely to the extent that I am challenged.
And so at this juncture, then, let me try and challenge you. And I think I've got 3 points, but I'm going to start with two. I think that the first point, and this is something that I frequently find I'm accused of when I say similar things, like, you obviously, the Falkland Islands War was far before my time, but if I point out the hypocrisy of American interventionism in Iraq and Afghanistan, or even the Saudi intervention in Yemen, or recently even this week with the Israeli attacks on the Jenin refugee camp in Palestine or in the occupied West Bank, people will go, well, this is just whataboutism. You know, you're just saying, well, what about this? What about this? And actually, you raise relevant points, but it's not helpful to the now. And so the American and Western arming of Ukraine is still a valuable endeavor, and it shouldn't be turned around by someone going, oh, but they're imperialists who did the same thing 10 years ago. And so how would you respond to this point that, whilst, yes, America did bad in the past and continues to do bad now, they still, their support for Ukraine is potentially still fine and viable, is my first point. And I'll come back to the second one afterwards.
I hope you will get back to the second. On the first one, I think the primary charge or the primary obligation of protection of human rights is on local constituencies in Western developed societies. They have, I mean, the only force in the world that can change the foreign policy of the United States are American citizens inside the United States through the American political process. So in other words, that nothing is going to change in what the United States will do abroad until there are legal and constitutional and political safeguards against unilateralism, against aggressive foreign policy. So what has changed inside the United States, inside Congress, inside the administration about foreign policy and its implications and its human rights implications since the war in Iraq or Afghanistan before that, or even going back to Vietnam and Kampuchea? How come that Kampuchea was denied its seat in the United Nations by American veto power for 10 years during the Nixon administration and so on, Vietnam did exactly what the United States did in Vietnam itself, of course, which is the hypocrisy of so-called third world or developing countries foreign policy, that the Vietnam invaded and occupied Kampuchea in the name of ridding the country of Pol Pot and his atrocities. For that, the country was punished by denial of its own seat in the United Nations. It was given to a government that had absolutely no power on the ground to protect anything. So anyway, my point is to say that I will take the claim that I should not protest American imperialism and relativism because it happened in the past. It doesn't mean that it will happen now. And absolutely certain that it will happen now and it will keep happening until the American public stand up and refuse and reject this interventionist and aggressive foreign policy. I have not seen any evidence of that. I have lived in the United States for almost 30 years now, and I have not seen any evidence of public awareness. I mean, still the issues that divide the country and the priorities that come up every 4 years in so-called national elections is the same: abortion, arms. You can't even regulate arms control in your own country. How can you control and regulate arms control globally? I mean, mass shootings, it happened only this week too. Someone will just come into a crowd and start shooting at random. And again, we go back, oh no, it's not, weapons don't kill, it's people who kill. But people who have submachine guns that they can buy on a common store in the corner, in the local neighborhood, kill more people faster and more efficiently, quote unquote, than people who are using knives or foe or whatever sort of limited means of that nature. So I'm sorry to carry on, but my point is this: to say, when I see in Britain, in the United States, in France, when I see a change of public opinion about accountability of their own governments, about human rights violation, the question of the refugees in Europe is a tremendously significant issue, because refugees are really the primary example of what human rights subjects are, because they don't have any protection by any state, including their own. And yet they are denied. So Britain is, the European Union generally is conspiring with African warlords to prevent African refugees from coming to Europe. We pay Turkey so that it keeps Syrian refugees in Turkey. But there is no real responsibility for the human rights of refugees in Europe itself by European states' domestic policy. So I don't really see a distinction between domestic and foreign that sharp. It is both are driven by political mobilization and push by local constituencies, not instead of trying to attempt coercive enforcement globally.
Okay, and then this was going to be my second point. It was going to be on the coercive enforcement of human rights, which you say shouldn't take place and it doesn't work. I was at a side event a couple of weeks ago, and it was a side event run by an organization that supported Hazari women in Afghanistan. And the Hazari women are a minority Shia sect in Afghanistan who not only struggle from the general kind of anti-women environment there, but also kind of their discrimination is confounded by their religious minority status as well. And people were really asking in the room, you know, what can be done? And Western countries need to be providing humanitarian visas. That's the first thing. And I think that's what they could be doing a lot more of. But to an extent, if a country is completely unwilling to protect these people, and these people are not only the victims of state violence, but they're the victim of non-state actor violence as well, and they're not protected, to what extent should the national community coercively enforce the human rights of these women and their partners and their children who are living in persecution and struggling to receive aid? What can be done?
Nothing. And it has never happened. The Universal Declaration is now 70 years. I judge by my own age. I mean, like, because I was born 46, the Universal Declaration was adopted 48. Wherever did international coercive enforcement and protection of human rights happen? And where can it be sustained, or has it been sustained?
Is this not what you wanted the UN to do in Kigali in 1992 when they instead left the country?
Because that was supposed to be the international regime that was in force. And because of that failure that I came almost like a sort of a rude awakening, really it was naive of me. It was really a betrayal of the victims of genocide for me as a human rights advocate, so-called, to expect the United Nations to protect human rights when the Security Council had the power to, you know, everything under Chapter 7, nothing can happen without the Security Council unanimous approval. Any of the five permanent members can block anything, as now with the case with Russia and the Ukraine, as it can be also referred to in the China policies regarding Muslims in West China and so on elsewhere. So the point is that unless you get the unanimous support of the five permanent members, nothing will happen under Chapter 7. And without Chapter 7, there is no possibility of coercive enforcement anywhere, even if there is unanimous conviction and determination by the entire world, except that single states, which is blocking it at the United Nations. So, I mean, I'm curious at the conference or the meeting that you attended, what did people expect the international community to do to protect the right of these women? All women are minorities or a minority in Afghanistan. There is tremendous persecution. After 15 years of American occupation, the women of Afghanistan are worse off today than they were before the American invasion of Afghanistan. So how can we justify invading countries and violating their sovereignty in the name of protection of the rights of women and minorities and abandon, negotiate with the same Taliban 10, 15 years later in order to be able to allow to leave the country? You know, the United States was negotiating about how to exit, not about how protection of human rights can continue after they leave. So I'm saying that the question for me is that coercive enforcement is practically impossible because it requires tremendous resources and sustained commitment. And ironically, the democratic principle blocks that possibility because no foreign, no Western, so-called West European and North American states can engage in foreign policy protection of human rights, or let alone coercive enforcement anywhere, without their local constituency approving it and sustaining that approval. So whenever, you know, the issues are debated in terms of what will the American voter think? What will the American voter do? And politicians, rightly so, are worried about what the American voter does. For my point, therefore, is let us work on the American voter as work on any other voter. I'm not singling the United States unfairly, although for all practical purposes, it is the primary example of anything wrong with the international system and international human rights protection that we're talking about. So work on the local sort of constituencies. When American public is willing to vote for committing troops in order to protect human rights of women in Afghanistan or anywhere else, and sustain that commitment over time, despite the material cost. Of course, there is some human cost, but it's primarily the material cost, how much it costs to do this. And then let us see what happens, but that is never going to happen. It will not happen in Britain. It will not happen in the Netherlands or in any other country. Netherlands is now claiming to be the global capital of universal, you know, transitional justice and transitional, international justice and so on. But in its own foreign policy, its own domestic policy, in its own refugees policy, I don't see that. And therefore, I am pleading, please show me where and when did coercive enforcement happen, unsustained over time.
And of course, you know, we are reflecting on the past two decades or more of geopolitics, of interventionism. And when the Iraq conflict occurred, when the Afghanistan intervention occurred, it was a very different economic reality as well in these countries. It was a time of economic prosperity, of debt-driven, but prosperous nonetheless. And of course, you know, it was very much the fringe elements who were asking, you know, in the context of a very polarized debate around religion and around culture, you know, is religion, is culture really the biggest obstacle to the protection of human rights today? You know, and they were sort of pointing to issues of economic inequality, for example. And indeed, in many ways, that's perhaps what focuses the mind more of those domestic populaces in those countries today, in a way which perhaps wasn't on their radar in 2001, 2003.
Yes, I think you are right that global environment and context change over time, domestic politics and situations change over time. But for me, it should be a question of stable versus transitional measures. I mean, so the fundamental basic mission is the universal protection of human rights, truly on universal terms, consistent with the nature of human rights themselves as the rights of the human by virtue of their humanity, instead of relying on our own domestic politics. So it is, we protect human rights when it's convenient, and we send troops when it serves our foreign policy security needs, but we don't do that we pull out, even worse, prematurely and arbitrarily in Iraq or Afghanistan or elsewhere, because it's no longer in our foreign policy interest to do so. So if it's your foreign policy interest, yeah, let's talk about that. And by all means, let's stick to international relations. But don't claim to have a new doctrine of universal, very noble and very brilliant doctrine of universal humanity, entitled to the basic rights by virtue of their humanity. Let's pretend, stop the pretense of talking about something that is supreme and divine or ordained by some, by the way, yes, culture and politics are always there, and they are part of the story always. And it is really naive of interest, because I see the obstacles and the problems of true, effective, consistent, universal protection of human rights in the reality of cultural and religious, which of course is not, it's not a feature of the post-colonial world. It's a feature of European societies and North Americans. I mean, is Europe culture free? Is Europe or the North America culture free? Doesn't culture control and the outcome of politics and everything else? So it is not as if that's what I object to in the book about the decolonizing human rights, about the so-called cultural relativism notion. Cultural relativism is a feature of the third world, of the developing world. We are above that. We are beyond that. But of course, we are beyond that precisely because you are in your own cultural relativism. So there is no human being who's neutral by nature, or that there is a culture that is neutral. There is all sorts of biases and prejudices and discrimination. And of course, that spells out into concrete action when you come to a crisis like the Ukraine or Iraq or Yemen.
So if we look to the future, Abdu, you know, you've also reflected on sort of the long sweep of history and how history informs the present. And, you know, one of the things which struck me in reading your book was the reflection on the fact that, you know, when the UN Charter was actually negotiated, the vast majority of human beings around the world were still living under colonial rule. So the notion that we could have some or they could have some conception of universal human rights was totally inconceivable. And in many ways, the sort of post-Second World War era is understood, at least in the Western canon, as sort of this shift from the age of empire to the age of the nation state. And indeed, you also write about, you know, some of the contradictory impulses there, that state rights are not the same as human rights. And yet the state itself, the very notion of the state, those inequalities created by the nation state system contributed to processes of decolonization. Mm-hmm. So we're still right in the sort of the thick of these historical impulses and trends that are still with us today. And I wondered, you know, in reflecting on the future of human rights, perhaps also you might want to reflect or weave in some reflection on the current situation in Sudan as well, your homeland. I mean, yes. How would you understand that as kind of a microcosm of some of these much bigger macro puzzles and paradoxes that we've been grappling with today?
Yes, actually, the tragedy that is going on in Sudan as we speak is really a reproduction of the same model of type of, I mean, who's arming the so-called rapid support forces, who's arming and financing. Neither side can fight any war, even for a day, without foreign finance and foreign armament. So it is the same, whether it is Liberia, where it is Sierra Leone, Congo, permanently Congo, or sort of, I mean, to think about the cost of international intervention and Western imperial greed in these situations is tremendous. Now, I think it is really ironic that and we now talk about the Universal Declaration as a sacred document, that it was sort of came from almost like the tablets coming from God to humanity by sort of miraculous means. It was a product of negotiations among major powers. And it was France and Britain who were opposed to human rights being available to colonial subjects, so-called, conceding that we can have the Universal Declaration in those terms without imposing those limitations, because they are assured by the doctrine itself and by the process that it's not going to affect their foreign policy or the colonial policy. France fought 10 years of anti-liberation war in Algeria until 1962. The Universal Declaration was declared in Paris in 1948. Until 1962, France was fighting a war in Algeria to deny Algerians the right to self-determination. And Britain continued to, I mean, when did Kenya become independent? 1962. And look at the rest of the Indian, I mean, of the British so-called empire. So the point for me is that when change is happening, when transformative, fundamental change is happening, people who are in it are not necessarily aware of the fact that it is happening. Yeah, when so-called the European Enlightenment happened, Europeans at the time did not realize they were going through an Enlightenment process, and they will come out enlightened. And they have not come out enlightened because Europe launched its, France and Britain primarily, launched their entire African imperial adventure after the European Enlightenment, to colonize African people. So the point for me, when we talk about, in religious terms, talk about the sort of reformation, the people who were living through the reformation did not realize that they were living through a reformation. It is now that we look back and see, that was the reformation. That was the enlightenment. And of course, it is simplistic, because the Reformation was not really that Reformation that much, and the Enlightenment was not an Enlightenment, except in relative terms, but not in universal terms. Because even at the height of Enlightenment, I'm sorry, just take too long, European philosophers who spoke about Enlightenment did not count. To Kant, I am not a human subject who is entitled to cosmopolitan awareness and self-determination, because he was thinking of the human as European, and therefore talking about universality is an afterthought, but for me it's a primary thought, and it's it is a tool and a means. It's a means and an end of self-determination.
Rather reminds me of the famous, perhaps apocryphal quote attributed to Gandhi when he was asked what he thought of Western civilization, and he responded, "I think it would be a good idea."
Yes, right. But of course, I mean, we shouldn't be chauvinistic about India either. So, after all, Gandhi was assassinated as an outcome of Indian politics. And now, 70 years later, we are the same type of issues that he was struggling against is still persist in India and even rising. So I think that the, to conclude, if you may, that the point is for me is I see a global humanity and I see a relativist consciousness and contextual realities of humanity everywhere. And for me, coming from that perspective, I am willing to tolerate and to work with local relativities to the extent that they are aware of and are committed to transformation of their own limitations. But when I see arrogance and hypocrisy prevailing in the, I published a chapter in a book back in 2002 or 2003, I call it from upholding international legality against American and Islamic jihad. 9/11 was part of our conversation somehow in the background, but basically the disaster is not only in the attack of 9/11, but in the American response. And the American response has been more of a disaster for international legality and for the protection of human rights, Guantanamo Bay, and which continues now, 25 years later, than just simply the attack on because 9/11 happened in Iraq, in New York, in the heartland of American consciousness and self-worth, the Americans were sort of thrown into a primitive, total global campaign of terror and kidnapping and torture. You know, they paid regimes to torture people and give them the outcome because they wouldn't want to torture them themselves. They set up Guantanamo Bay just outside the United States jurisdiction in order to deny American courts the right to protect those persons who are subject to US sovereignty and control by American standards themselves, let alone international standards. So my conclusion, therefore, will be I am a permanent, to my sort of conviction and practice of protection of human rights as best as I can. But I am grateful for human rights for liberating me from my relativism, from my post-colonial subjectivity, and really enabled me to see clearly what is going on and contribute to it.
Thank you. And I think just one final question from me, and this would be, as someone who self-describes, I guess, as an activist and a scholar and speaks to the value of being a scholar as an activist, would you have any advice for young people that look around and look around themselves and the situations that they see the world in, and they recognize the inequality and the violence and the prejudice and the subjugation? What advice would you have for these young people aspiring to engage in a world with integrity and build a better world?
Yes, thank you. Of course, that is the question. I mean, that the conclusion of our conversation has always to be, what else can we do? What can we do better, more effectively, and so on? In 1990, the first book I published in English was called Toward an Islamic Reformation, Civil Liberties, Human Rights, and International Law. And in that, I founded my conviction in the universality of human rights and international protection or international legality through what I called the notion of reciprocity, the idea do unto others, the golden rule. To me, the golden rule is all we need to affirm if we are willing to live up to it. So basically, when I'm living sort of as I am now, I have to be grateful for the blessings of comfort and, you know, power in my house and YouTube and all that stuff going on. The question for me is how in that sort of notions of comfort and oh, I have to do this, I have to do that for others, not for myself, is always to turn the question around and to say, what about what I am doing concretely, not just simply in terms of what I do through op-eds and newsletters and social media. It's what I'm willing to sacrifice for. I think, unfortunately, I have to mention this. What's going on in Israel and the West Bank and Gaza is a tremendous tragedy. And it's a total betrayal of the idea of Israel itself. I think if any sort of supporters and sympathizers with the state of Israel and the idea of the state of Israel are candid and honest with themselves, they would realize that they cannot perpetuate an occupation of Palestinian West Bank and Gaza Strip and the conditions that they are enforcing in Gaza in particular for decades without being challenged. I mean, talking about the Geneva Conventions and the treatment of territorial, occupied territories, and to see what's going on with building sort of settlements and expanding, almost taking over the entire West Bank now. And sort of, and we claimed, who's going to ask for this if not Israelis themselves, challenging their own domestic and foreign policy, because it is more domestic than foreign in the case of Israel, regarding the Palestinian issues. And the rest of us, we protest when we can, we write letters, this and that, but is that the most that we can do? Or is there something more that we can do concretely? So my answer to your question is, let us challenge ourselves before we challenge anybody else. And let's confront ourselves by the contradictions and the hypocrisies of our own discourse, that we are activists at sort of at convenience, at pleasure. But realizing that, in fact, because we have the freedom to act and to speak, we have a stronger obligation and a constant obligation to protect these rights everywhere for all of those who are denied those rights, just simply because of acknowledging the golden rule, do unto others.
I think that's a really good piece of advice, that we should all be grateful for what we have. And then once we really realize how lucky we are to have the things that we have, we should use that to fight for the rights of those that don't have it. And I think that that's a really good lesson to live by. And so with that, I think we thank you for joining us on this podcast today. And it's been a real privilege and pleasure. And I hope that people enjoyed listening to it. And yeah, I that's it. I mean,
well, wonderful. Yeah. Thank you, Tom and Tom. The two Toms, and thank you for your colleagues. Sometimes you say your team. My respect and appreciation to all your team, and it has been a tremendous opportunity, and I hope it will be a continuation of the conversation rather than a conclusion of it.
That would be wonderful, Abdu. We very much hope we will be able to continue this conversation. And I'm sure we'll get a great response from our audience and probably lots of questions you at a later time.
You know, I'm retired now, so I'm my time is entirely devoted to this. I don't have any other occupations or distractions. So I'm happy. As I said, I'm not relevant if I'm not challenged. When I am challenged, I hope I have a convincing or persuasive response.
Well, we're very grateful for your time and for your insights. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to Imperfect Utopias or Bust, Global Governance Futures. If you liked this content, please do leave us a comment and subscribe. If you're new to the show and you want to get a list of our favorite books, other resources, listen to past shows, and to join our community, go to ucl.ac.uk/global-governance.